Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. So I predict we're going to see a lot more interest in everything blockchain and distributed storage related in coming years. I'm currently taking a backup, you'll be glad to hear, of our episode archive. Our episodes are hosted on Cloudflare, but I'm doing a backup onto Wasabi just to always have that. Because I've been delighted with the episodes we've had so far, more than 600 of them. I'm big into backups, as you know, and however many times I feel sometimes, well, backups are, we don't need backups anymore, tech is so good. But then you have these little things like the home server fracas that we talked about in a few episodes, and it makes you remember that it is important to take to make sure that your whatever data that you regard as important enough to protect is protected. And certainly this podcast has been kind of a treasure for me, the 600 episodes so far, which is why I'm currently looking at the Wasabi bucket, making sure that the backfill script, the every time we create an episode, we're uploading it to a second cloud, and now it's syncing down to my NAS. And finally, I'm going to even put it on optical media for long-term offline archival. So Herman and Corden, one tries not to overthink in the world of backup, because if you do start thinking about contingency and, you know, is two copies enough, you're going to drive yourself crazy. But the only reason that I think that even enters the equation when we're talking about cloud backup and offsite backup is we don't want to have a single point of failure. And even though companies like AWS and Google Cloud and even Wasabi are so big that we kind of just inherently trust them, we say that's a monolith, our data is safe if that's one of the places our backups are going. There is always maybe that slight niggling worry that is it really safe there? You know, it is a single point of failure. It's a company and stuff does happen, like people get locked out of their accounts. I think that the blockchain idea provides a really interesting kind of solution to that, with one caveat that I'm going to mention as we talk about this. The potential advantage is that if we take the blockchain model for a nodal network where we're never relying upon a single entity, and certainly in the cryptocurrency use case, we're looking at circumventing a central bank. For file storage, we're saying, well, everything is distributed, and if you know that your episodes are in the public domain, let's take the example of this podcast data, and we know that they've been pushed out to some blockchain, they're being replicated on so many nodes that the data will essentially always be there. Now, my question is, when we have our data shared out to, let's take the Interplanetary File System or the IPFS, can that actually be used as a backup? Like at some point in time, let's just take the worst case scenario that we're talking about here. I'm creating backups of this podcast. Worst case scenario, something catastrophic goes wrong, the website gets deleted, I get locked out of Cloudflare, and now I say, hey, I love that podcast, I had like 600 episodes. Oh wait, I put them up on IPFS, they're on the Interplanetary File System. What's my next move? How would I actually go about trying to grab that data back? Would I need to have like written down the exact bucket that I used? Because when we talk about backup, we need to know what the recovery process would look like to make sure that the backup is actually viable. The second question that I have, Herman and Corin, I said there was kind of a second order effect, as you guys love to call it, is if we have a public asset and we want it to be on something we're going to remove that single point of failure. The only negative I can think of is what happens if we later need to take down an episode. Let's say I said something or you said something that turned out to be a legal liability, and we got a threatening law letter from some company, and they said, you defamed us in this episode. So conventionally, we'd say, you know, if they had grounds, okay, we'll take the episode down, it's deleted from our server, it's finished. Now, what happens if that episode is already distributed on the on something like the interplanetary file system? Do we need to have access to ensure that we can actually, if that were the case, that we could get that episode removed? So there's a lot of implications, I think, Herman and Corden. I think from a backup perspective, I'm not sure that's usually what people think of when we talk about the advantages of a nodal-based storage architecture, but certainly that's what comes to mind for me. The other niggle I'd like to put out there as a backup enthusiast of sorts is, if we have this big interplanetary, you know, this concept of a distributed nodal-based file storage system sounds great, so long as two things occur. One, there are people using it, because if there's no one using it, there aren't going to be many nodes. And the second thing is, they don't really understand how it works. Let's take the amount of data in S3, for example. We're talking exabytes of data. If these systems rely upon these nodes and people storing some of the data, how does that actually work in practice? Because the infrastructure must be very significant. Or is this just an abstraction over the same type of storage that's being used in the first place in AWS? So there's a lot of things to talk about, Herman and Corden. Let's talk about the distributed file systems like the IPFS and their potential utility in offsite backup workflows. Can they give us the ultimate redundancy? Or if that's what we're looking for, are we better off sticking to multi-conventional cloud storages, things like S2, Wasabi, Backblaze, and all the rest of them? Over to you, Herman and Corden.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corn, and I am sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother, the man who probably has more redundant hard drives than he has pairs of socks.
Herman Poppleberry at your service. And hey, you can never have too many backups, Corn. One is none, two is one, and three is barely getting started. Although, after hearing the prompt our housemate Daniel sent over today, I might need to rethink my entire strategy.
Yeah, Daniel has been on a bit of a mission lately, hasn't he? He mentioned he is currently backing up over 600 episodes of this very podcast. He is using Cloudflare for hosting, Wasabi for a secondary cloud bucket, and then syncing it all down to a local storage server.
It is a solid 3-2-1 backup strategy. Three copies of the data on two different media, with one copy off-site. But Daniel is asking the big question, what if we could go beyond the big cloud providers entirely? He is looking into distributed file systems, specifically the Interplanetary File System, or IPFS, as a way to achieve what he calls ultimate redundancy.
It is a fascinating jump. We are moving from trusting a few massive corporations to trusting a decentralized network of potentially thousands of individual nodes. But, as with everything in the world of decentralized tech, the devil is in the details. Is it actually better for backups, or is it just more complicated?
That is exactly what we are going to tear apart today. We will look at the redundancy claims, the actual recovery process, because a backup is useless if you cannot get it back, and the legal and scaling headaches that come with putting your data out into the wild.
So let us start with the core concept. Redundancy. Most people think of cloud storage as this magical, indestructible place. If I put a file in Amazon S3 or Wasabi, it is safe, right?
Mostly, yes. Those providers have incredible durability ratings. We are talking 11 nines of durability in some cases. That means if you store 10 million objects, you might lose one every 10,000 years. But the point Daniel raised is the single point of failure. It is not about a hard drive failing at Amazon, it is about the account itself. You get locked out, the company changes its terms of service, or there is a massive regional outage like the one we saw last year that took down half the internet.
Right, and that is where the interplanetary file system comes in. For those who might not be deep in the weeds, how does it fundamentally differ from something like Wasabi or Google Drive?
The biggest shift is moving from location, addressing, to content. Addressing. In a traditional setup, if I want to find an episode of My Weird Prompts, I go to a specific URL. That URL points to a specific server at a specific IP address. If that server is down, I am out of luck.
But with IPFS, I am not looking for a location. I am looking for the thing itself.
Exactly. Every file in IPFS is hashed. You get a unique fingerprint called a content identifier, or a CID. If I want episode 500, I ask the network, hey, who has the file with this specific fingerprint? It does not matter who gives it to me, as long as the hash matches. It could be a server in Tokyo, a laptop in London, or a node running right here in Jerusalem.
So in theory, as long as one person on Earth has that file pinned and is connected to the network, the file exists and is accessible. That sounds like the ultimate redundancy. But here is my first concern, Herman. If I'm backing up my private data, say my tax returns or family photos, I do not necessarily want the whole world to be able to find them by their fingerprint.
And that is a huge misconception people have about these systems. IPFS is a protocol, not a storage service. If you just add a file to your local IPFS node, you are the only one who has it. Other people can only download it if they know the CID and your node is online. For a backup workflow, you would absolutely have to encrypt everything before it even touches the network using something like AES-256. You would be backing up encrypted blobs. The CID would just be the address for that encrypted chunk of data.
Okay, so I encrypt my data, I get my CID, and I push it to the network. How do I ensure it stays there? Because if I turn my computer off, and no one else has requested that file, it effectively vanishes from the network, right?
This is where the concept of pinning comes in. In the IPFS world, pinning is the act of telling a node, hey, do not delete this, do not treat it like temporary cache, keep a permanent copy. For a backup workflow, you would either need to run your own always-on nodes in different physical locations or use a pinning service. There are companies like Panada or Infura that basically charge you a monthly fee to keep your CIDs pinned on their high availability servers.
Wait a minute. If I am paying a company like Pinata to pin my files, haven't I just recreated traditional cloud storage with extra steps? I am back to trusting a single provider.
That is the sharpest critique of the current state of IPFS. If you are just using one pinning service, you have not gained much redundancy. The real power comes from the fact that the CID is universal. If Pinata goes out of business tomorrow, I do not have to re-upload my terabytes of data to a new provider. I just go to a different pinning service and say, hey, go find this CID on the network and start pinning it. Or I could spin up my own server and do it. The data is not trapped in a proprietary silo. It is just out there in the ether, and I am just choosing who I pay to hold on to it for me.
That is an interesting distinction. It is like having a storage unit where the key works at every storage facility in the world. You are not locked into the landlord. You are just renting the space. But let us talk about the recovery process. Daniel asked what that actually looks like. If my house burns down and I lose my local server, how do I get my 600 episodes back from the decentralized web?
It is actually a bit more nerve-wracking than a traditional download. In S3, you just hit a GET request and the data starts flowing at maximum speed. In IPFS, your client has to query something called a distributed hash table, or a DHT. It is basically a massive, decentralized phone book. Your node asks its neighbors, who has this CID, they ask their neighbors, and so on.
It sounds like it could be slow.
It can be incredibly slow. Finding the providers for a file can take seconds or even minutes, depending on the network health. And then, once you find them, you have to connect and start the transfer using a protocol called BitSwap. It is a bit like BitTorrent, where you can pull different pieces of a file from different peers simultaneously. For a large backup, like Daniel's archive, you would be pulling thousands of small chunks from various nodes.
And if those nodes have low upload bandwidth, your recovery time could be days instead of hours.
Exactly. And there is no service level agreement. If you are relying on the public network, no one owes you speed. This is why for professional workflows, people use private IPFS networks or dedicated peering. But for a home user, you are at the mercy of the peers. The other thing is that you have to keep track of those CIDs. If you lose the list of fingerprints for your files, you are finished. There is no forgot password button on the blockchain or the DHT. If you do not have the hash, the data is invisible.
So you need a backup for your backup's addresses. It is turtles all the way down. But let us move to the legal side of things, because this is where it gets really sticky. Daniel asked about content removal. Let us say he accidentally backs up something that he later gets a legal notice for. In a traditional cloud, you just hit delete. The provider wipes the sectors, and you are done. In a distributed network, how do you take it down?
Short answer? You don't. Not really. This is the double-edged sword of decentralization. If you push a file to the network and other people or services decide to pin it, you have lost control. It is like trying to unring a bell. You can stop pinning it on your end, you can ask your pinning service to delete it, but if some node in another country has cached it or pinned it, it stays alive.
That sounds like a nightmare for liability. If I am a business and I have a legal requirement to delete customer data after 5 years, can I even use IPFS?
Technically, if the data is encrypted and you destroy the encryption key, the data is effectively gone because it is just noise. This is called crypto shredding, but the encrypted blob still exists. From a strictly technical standpoint, IPFS has no built-in delete button for the network. There is garbage collection on individual nodes where unpinned data eventually gets cleared out to make room for new stuff. But if a file is popular, or if it has been archived by a third party, it is permanent.
And what about the gateways? Most people interact with IPFS through web gateways, right? Like the one run by Cloudflare or the IPFS.io gateway.
Right. Gateways are the bridge. They let you use a regular browser to see IPFS content. If a legal notice comes in, a gateway provider can block a specific CID. So, if you try to visit that hash through the Cloudflare gateway, you will get a 404 or a legal warning. But the data is still on the network. Anyone running a local node or using a different gateway can still see it. It is censorship resistant, which is great for activists, but potentially terrifying for compliance officers.
It feels like we are moving toward a world where data is immutable by default, and we have to build layers on top of it to simulate the ability to forget.
That is exactly it. There are some interesting projects trying to handle this, though. Some systems use a layer called IPNS, the Interplanetary Naming System, where a fixed name points to a CID, and you can update that name to point to nothing. But the original data is still there if you know the original CID. It is a fundamental shift in how we think about digital existence.
Let us talk about scale. Daniel's archive is significant, but it is not exabytes. Traditional cloud providers like Amazon handle truly massive scales of data. How does a decentralized network compare when we are talking about petabytes or exabytes?
This is where the physics of the network starts to bite. In a centralized data center, you have high-speed fiber interconnects between racks. You can move data at incredible speeds. In a decentralized network, you are limited by the slowest link in the chain. Managing a global hash table that indexes petabytes of data is a massive computational challenge.
So is I. PFS fundamentally different from the infrastructure of AWS? Or is it just a different way of organizing the same old servers?
It is fundamentally different in architecture, but in practice, it often sits on top of the same infrastructure. If you look at where most IPFS nodes are actually running, a huge percentage of them are hosted on Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud, and DigitalOcean.
Wait, really? So we are using a decentralized protocol that is running on centralized servers?
For now, yes. It is the path of least resistance. It is much easier to spin up a high-performance IPFS node in a data center than to rely on people's home internet connections. So, in a weird way, if AWS has a total global meltdown, a large chunk of the IPFS network might go dark too. Now, the protocol allows for a more resilient future where we all have little storage nodes in our houses, but we are not there yet. The performance just isn't there for massive scaling without some level of centralization.
That is the irony of it. We are building these complex decentralized systems to escape the big providers, but we are using the big providers to make the systems fast enough to use.
It is a transition period. But there is another piece to the scaling puzzle, and that is incentives. Why would I, a random person in Jerusalem, use my hard drive space and my bandwidth to store Daniel's podcast episodes?
Exactly. Unless I am a fan, I have no reason to help him with his backup.
Right. And that is where things like Filecoin come in. Filecoin is basically an incentive layer built on top of IPFS. It is a blockchain where you pay providers and cryptocurrency to store your data for a specific amount of time. As of early 2026, the Filecoin network is actually hosting over 15 exabytes of data. They have to provide cryptographic proof, called proof of spacetime, to show they are actually holding your bits. This creates a competitive market for storage.
Does that make it more like a traditional cloud provider?
It makes it a decentralized marketplace. Instead of one company setting the price, you have thousands of providers bidding to store your data. It can be significantly cheaper than S3, sometimes by a factor of 10 or more. But the complexity is much higher. You have to manage wallets, deal with storage deals, and handle the possibility that a provider might just disappear and lose their collateral.
It sounds like a lot of work for a backup. I mean, if I am Daniel, I just want to know that if my laptop dies, I can get my files back. If I have to become a crypto economic expert just to manage my offsite storage, I might just stick with Wasabi.
And that is the reality for most people right now. IPFS and Filecoin are amazing for certain use cases, like public archives, scientific datasets, or censorship-resistant websites. But for a personal backup workflow, the friction is still very high. You are trading convenience for a very specific type of sovereign redundancy.
So let us look at the practical takeaways. If someone listening is thinking, okay, I want to try this. I want to move my backups to a distributed system. What is the actual workflow today?
If I were doing it, I would start with a tool like rClone. We have talked about rClone before on the show. It is like the Swiss Army knife of cloud storage. It actually has an IPFS backend. So you could set up a script that encrypts your files, hashes them, and then pushes them to an IPFS node or a pinning service.
But you still need that pinning service.
You do. Unless you want to run a server at your office and a server at your house and have them peer with each other. That would give you a private, distributed backup. If the house burns down, the office has the blocks. If the office burns down, the house has them. And since it is IPFS, if you need to add a third location, it is as simple as spinning up a new node and telling it to pin the same CIDs. It would pull the data from the other two nodes automatically.
That actually sounds like a very elegant way to manage multi-site backups without needing a central coordinator. No VPNs, no complex sync software, just the IPFS daemon running and sharing blocks.
Exactly. That is where the technology really shines. It is the protocolization of storage. Instead of having to configure a specific sync relationship between server A and server B, you just tell both servers to care about the same content. The network handles the discovery and the transfer.
Okay, but what about the legal side we mentioned earlier? If I am using this for a business, how do I handle the right to be forgotten?
You have to handle it at the encryption layer. As we said, crypto shredding is the only real answer. You store the data on the distributed network, but you manage the keys in a centralized or more controlled way. If you need to delete a file, you delete the key. The encrypted blocks stay on IPFS forever, but they are useless. They are just digital noise. It is not a perfect solution for every regulatory framework, but it is the standard way to handle immutability.
It is like throwing a locked safe into the middle of the ocean. The safe is still there, but if you melt the key, no one is ever getting inside.
That is a perfect analogy. And as long as the ocean is large enough and the safe is strong enough, that is effectively a deletion.
So, looking at the big picture, does IPFS provide ultimate redundancy compared to multi-cloud?
I would say it provides a different kind of redundancy. Multi-cloud protects you against a provider failing. IPFS protects you against the concept of a provider existing at all. It is a more robust, long-term architecture for the human race's data. If we want our podcast to be findable in 100 years, IPFS is a much better bet than hoping a specific company's billing system is still running.
I like that. It is about the longevity of the data itself, not the longevity of the contract.
Precisely. But for Daniel's immediate problem, which is making sure he doesn't lose the archive of my weird prompts next week, a combination of Wasabi and a local NAS is probably more reliable because the tooling is more mature. IPFS is still in that early, exciting, but slightly broken phase.
It reminds me of the early days of Linux. You could do amazing things, but you had to be willing to spend your Saturday afternoon fixing a driver.
Exactly. We are still in the command line era of distributed storage, but the progress is fast. Every year, the DHT gets more stable, the gateways get faster, and the integration with tools like rClone gets smoother.
One thing that struck me in Daniel's prompt was the mention of massive scales. We talked about how IPFS can be slow, but there is also the issue of deduplication. That is a huge advantage for scale, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the hidden superpowers of content addressing. Imagine you have 1,000 people all backing up the same operating system files. In a traditional cloud, the provider stores 1,000 copies. In IPFS, because the address is the content, every node that has those files is contributing to the same CID. The network effectively deduplicates at a global scale.
So if Daniel is backing up our episodes, and someone else is also backing them up, they are essentially helping each other.
Yes, they are part of the same swarm. If Daniel's node goes down, his recovery client can pull those blocks from the other person's node. That is a level of cooperative redundancy that you just don't get with traditional cloud providers. You are not just a customer, you are part of a library.
That is a beautiful way to think about it. The internet is a giant shared library where we all help keep the books on the shelves.
It is a very optimistic vision of technology. And I think that is why people like Daniel are so drawn to it. It feels more like the original spirit of the web. Peer-to-peer, resilient, and not owned by anyone.
But we have to balance that optimism with the reality of latency and complexity. I think my takeaway for today is that IPFS is an incredible secondary or tertiary backup target. Use your traditional cloud for the stuff you might need to recover tomorrow. Use IPFS for the stuff you want to make sure exists for your grandchildren.
I agree. It is the deep archive, the digital time capsule. And for a podcast like ours, where we are talking about these weird evolving ideas, there is something poetic about storing it on a system that is designed to outlive us all.
Even the episodes where we just argue about your hard drive collection?
Especially those, Korn. Those are historical documents. Future civilizations need to know the struggle of managing 16 terabyte parity drives.
God help them. Well, I think we have covered a lot of ground here. We looked at the content addressing model, the reality of pinning versus magical storage, the legal headaches of immutability, and why we are still tethered to the big cloud providers even when we try to escape.
It is a journey. We are not at the destination yet, but the road is being built under our feet. And hey, before we wrap up, I should probably mention that if you are out there listening and you have your own weird backup strategies, or if you have actually managed to build a seamless IPFS workflow, we want to hear about it.
Definitely. You can reach out through the contact form at myweirdprompts.com. We love hearing how people are applying these ideas in the real world.
And if you are enjoying the show, whether you are in episode 1 or episode 626, we would really appreciate a quick review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps the show reach new people who are just as nerdy as we are.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. We are available on Spotify, and you can find the full RSS feed and all our past episodes at our website.
Which, for the record, is backed up in at least 4 different places now, thanks to Daniel.
At least. All right, I think that is a wrap for today. This has been My Weird Prompts. I am Korn.
And I am Herman Poppleberry. Thanks for joining us in the living room.
Stay curious, and keep those backups redundant. We will talk to you next time.
Goodbye, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.